You're listening to After Images, a podcast for cinephiles that takes a deep dive into moving images. Each episode features a special guest who is invited to explore a film of their choice. After Images is hosted by film writers Franck Bouleg and Marisa C. Hayes. On today's episode, our guest, novelist and screenwriter Peter Atkins, joins us for a discussion of Jean Cocteau's 1950 masterpiece, Orphée. Set in 1950s Paris, the film is a modern exploration of the Greek myth of Orpheus and Eurydice. Jean Marais plays Orphée, a famous poet who is driven to a castle by the princess, who reanimates the young poet, Segeste. As she disappears through a mirror, Orphée is driven back to his home by her driver, Eurtubise. There we meet Eurydice, Orphée's wife, and while Eurtubise falls in love with her, Orphée becomes obsessed with listening to the abstract poetry that only comes through the Rolls-Royce's radio. With its fantastic effects and artful design, Orphée is a magnificent film about death, poetry, dreams, and the mysterious zone in between. The film has remained a major source of inspiration for some of the most important filmmakers of recent years, including Tarkovsky, Kurosawa, and Lynch.
Peter Atkins is the author of the novel Morning Star, Big Thunder, and Moon Town, and the screenplays Hellraiser 2, Hellraiser 3, Hellraiser 4, and Wishmaster. His short fiction has been selected 8 times for one or more of the various Year's Best anthologies, and his newest book is the story collection All Our Hearts Are Ghosts.
Peter Atkins, welcome to After Images podcast. We're delighted to have you here today.
Well, hello, Frank and Marisa, and I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. And you chose to discuss Jean Cocteau's 1950 Orphée or Orpheus. And I'd really like to begin with the question, why did you select this film? What has it meant to you? And maybe set the scene for us. Let us know about the first time you saw it and how things may have changed over time, if it's a film that you have enjoyed revisiting.
Sure. Well, I chose it because it's essentially my favorite movie. I usually say, well, like all of us, you know, I have a floating top 25, and the actual positions within that 25 can vary depending on mood and time. But even more specifically than that, I very much have a top 3. Especially a top 3 in the genre of the fantastique. And that would be Bride of Frankenstein, King Kong, and Orphée. And I think that they have, the reason they are my holy trinity of the fantastic, I think, is of the commonalities, not only the obvious superficial, you know, they're all in black and white, and they're all massively entertaining, as well as thought-provoking. But the thing I always like to start off a conversation about Orphée, or indeed Kong or Bride, is that I think fairly rarely within the field, especially of fantastic on the screen, they're all examples of what scholars like yourselves might call Gnostic cinema, because unlike, by which I mean that they are, in their different ways, all overtly about what many fantasy movies are covertly about, which is the search for knowledge, especially forbidden knowledge. And the great thing about those three movies is that unlike so many movies that are about the search for forbidden knowledge, they don't wag their finger at us. They are, in fact, implicitly, if not explicitly, on the side of the people who want to know. You know, you've got Carl Denham in King Kong, and you've got Frankenstein himself, but also the magnificent Dr. Pretorius in Bride of Frankenstein. And here you have the poet Orpheus. And they are, in each case, determined to pierce the... I did an essay on Orphé about 20 years ago for Mark Morris's Cinema Macabre book, and I started with an epigraph from James Elroy Flecker's poem Hassan, which is the famous couplet from it. For lust of knowing what should not be known, we take the golden road to Samarkand. And I think that that is the engine that drives, well, drives Cocteau, obviously, and it drives the movie and drives those other two movies as well. But to narrow it down specifically to Orphé, having put it in the somewhat unusual, probably for serious film scholars, company of Bride and Kong, Orphé itself, I first saw, I guess 50 or 51 years ago. I can't remember if I was 19 or 20. And I saw it for people who like your podcast, who are probably genre cinema fans. I saw it with Pinhead. My friend Doug Bradley and I saw it in Liverpool at a not really a rep theatre, but a little art society that showed movies you couldn't see elsewhere. And Doug Bradley and I saw Orphé in either 1974 or 1975. So I would have been 18, 19, or 20, depending what time in the year it was. And it was devastatingly wonderful. I had not seen, or I hadn't felt anything like that before. And it seemed to me, in a way, and still does, 50 years later, very much its own flavor, but a flavor that I thought I had been looking for. It's hard for me to, I can talk about the meaning of the film and the look of the film, and it's hard for me to explain the feelings the film can engender. But I did feel that I was in the presence of something that was speaking the language I'd always wanted art to speak to me in, if that's not too convoluted a sentence. The range of tones and the confidence in which Cocteau, well, not I was going to say juggled, but not even juggled, just melded and molded those tones together. Every time he risks pretension, and he's brave enough to risk pretension, but every time he risks pretension, he'll undercut it with some smart ass, funny, slightly sour comment. I watched it again. I realized I hadn't seen it for, as you get older, you let the years pile up, excuse me, between viewings of even your favorite movies. And I realized it had been a long time since I saw it. So knowing we were going to have this conversation, I watched it a couple of days ago. And, obviously I remembered most of it pretty well, but I was yet again surprised at how quickly it gets going. It's not like I'd forgotten that the princess shows up so quickly, but experientially I felt like I'd forgotten. It was like, oh my God, she's here already. And she brings Segeste into the Café des Poètes. And it's like, oh, we're just hitting the ground running. Here she is. That opening sequence is still, it's so fabulous. That obviously we're going to glimpse other worlds in the movie in a more traditional sense. We're going to go to the zone, go to the beyond. But just the cafe society, specifically, in which poetry is the center of the world, and it's so important to these, you can tell how Cocteau was casting, because all these beautiful young men with fabulous pompadour hairdos, every one of them. I'd also forgotten, I mean, being heterosexual myself, I'd never forgotten how fabulous Maria Cazares is. Is it Cazares, by the way, or Cazare? How is it? Do we know how it's pronounced officially?
But I am not certain.
Nor me. It's you see it written down, and unfortunately, we don't hear her discussed often enough. So let's say Cazares, and I hope that's correct. So I'd never forgotten how fabulous she looks. But But I had forgotten how fabulous Jean Marais looks. I mean, as soon as you see him, it's like, my God, what a beautiful man. And Edouard Damiette as well, of course. And Juliette Gréco is in the. I've been distracted by their beauty. What were we talking about? Oh, yeah. So it was great to see how we were plunged into this world in which poetry is the center of the world, and losing one's muse is devastating. You also instantly have the wit when, in case it's getting pretentious, is it four, no longer than 4 minutes, I think, before the guy Orphée is having a coffee with pulls out the Princess's Review, nudism, and all the pages blank, which is just hilarious and great. But it never cracks a smile. The movie itself doesn't crack a smile. Orphée is a little disgusted with the review, but just figures he's done. So I've really lost track of what the question was. I'm sorry, but yes, having just recently watched it again a couple of days ago, I was, well, as ever, one is always relieved when one watches a favorite. There's like, oh my God, yeah, it's still fantastic. There's I it I'm not going to quibble with the great departed Jean because I love him and his work so much. The first half of Act Three, where we sort of slip into domestic farce when we come back from the zone the first time after Eurydice is rescued from the underworld. I mean, first of all, maybe this was the revelation to me this time that when I was a callower young man, I hadn't realized what an asshole Orphée is. My God. And I mean, obviously, our heart is with him, and we're on his side for the great quest to the unknown. But what a dick! What a self-centered terror! And then I'm very relieved to see that the movie completely acknowledges that. And then when they have this sort of the touching narrative ending, which of course in a way isn't really the thematic ending because we know the relationship that counts is Orphée and death, not Orphée and Eurydice. But it's humanistically touching that the human lovers are restored. And like all borderline sociopathic narcissists, he's happy and gleeful and he's hugging his wife and they're talking about their child. And he says he will be unbearable, just like his father. So it's like, okay, so Cocteau knows that that artists are spoiled children. But he also knows that, they are the most important people in the world. And so again, I'm so sorry. I don't know why. Was I still babbling or has there been a second question? And I'm sorry.
No, it's a
No.
great answer to hear about how this film has affected you and also how it's shifted over time. It's always such a relief to revisit old
Right.
favorites and see that they hold up and that there's
Yes.
something new to catch every time.
And I also totally
Sure.
agree with you. I mean, the film is called Orpheus, but it could very well have been called A Narcissus, couldn't it?
Right. Right, and then it could be on a triple bill with Black Narcissus and Black Orpheus, and there's this whole sort of strange interplay of all of them. Yeah, exactly. The self-awareness of the narcissism of the artist in the movie, that was perhaps new to me because I'm possibly being an old man now, I'm less narcissistic myself. Because I think as a young man, it was just we were completely on Orphée's side. It's like, yes, you must ignore all human passions and commitments because you're tuning in to the beyond. I mean, literally tuning in. I mean, this is the other, again, I'm not telling you guys anything you don't know, but that device of the car radio picking up these messages from the beyond so that the poet can have direct access from his muse. Even though, of course, and I did understand this back in the day, though it seemed more pointed in my recent viewing. He's just stealing. They're not messages from the beyond. They're suggests. Suggest comes up with all those great phrases, l'oiseau chante avec ses doigts une fois, which I always misquote. I always say deux fois because I think nearly every other transmission is followed by deux fois. But the famous "the bird sings with its fingers" is une fois. But and perhaps you guys would know, is it true that in the same way that Segeste wrote the lines and Orphée lifted them, Cocteau asked Apollinaire or somebody, I believe the lines on the radio are not Cocteau's, they are a French poet,
I did
I
not know
think.
that. I didn't.
I should have Googled this before we spoke, and
That's
then I could have looked more authoritative.
I don't know, but it wouldn't be surprising, would it, in terms of the types of collaborations that he's made
Right,
throughout
right.
his films?
Exactly. Yes. I think it mightn't be Apollinaire, but was Apollinaire, were they contemporaries? I know as younger men, back,
It's not
in the days of
okay.
Parade and Rites of Spring and stuff.
No.
But yeah, would Apollinaire still have been around in
I think so.
1950?
I think he was probably dead by then.
But it's
Yeah,
he's
yeah.
kind of this iconic figure for that cafe culture of Saint-Germain-des-Prés,
Right,
which
right.
we're immediately plunged into, and it's so contemporary right from the beginning, and you
Oh,
when it opens
it's
and the cafes.
yes. It that yeah, because that's the other thing. I mean, obviously, like any movie that lives long enough, it is. I use the term non-pejoratively, it is dated, but it's timelessly cool. As soon as we're in that cafe, well, like we said earlier, the men and the women are so beautiful, but they're also so stylish, elegant, and effortlessly cool, all of them. Which, especially probably to a 19-year-old that saw that movie, that's part of the appeal. It's like, oh, I would love to be in a world in which we were all as cool as these people.
I'm wondering if this timeless, sorry to interrupt.
No, go.
I was wondering if this timelessness might not be linked also to the fact that the film is about a myth, that that it takes a mythological level.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, of course, and I can't remember it verbatim, but I assume it's Cocteau's voice, his own voice in the opening narration. I don't know that for a fact. But he says, I'm paraphrasing this badly, but exactly as you're saying, Frank, he what is a myth? Where does it belong? Where can we tell it? We choose to tell it here. And tell it well they do. But yeah, it does seem timeless, and its sense of the cool as a conceptual seems equally timeless. You might have listeners to this episode, I guess, to whom this movie is as yet unseen. I don't know that, but I want to say, although we're having a great time talking about how good looking they are and how cool they are, it's a serious movie as well as a beautiful and fun movie, and it has a lot to say about the human relationship with life's relationship with death, both metaphorically and very literalized in the movie. And so I wanted to be clear that this is a beautifully highbrow movie, as well as being completely, I feel it is capable of being absolutely appealing to, and I don't use the term dismissively or in a reductionist sense, but completely capable of feeling to normal people. It has its highbrow aspect, but Cocteau's touch and feel for, well, as I say, his ability to undercut his own pretension with his own humor is one of the great places of the movie. We should also probably talk about, the look of the, not just the look of the people who are great, But the look of the movie itself, some of it, I guess, simply historically accidental, because it is filmed in 49 and I guess released in the rest of Europe in 1950. So it's very immediately post-war and very post-occupation. And well, before we go on to the look of it, we should mention that that's the other great and moving thing about the radio broadcasts is that the thing that that echoes for a lot of people, particularly a generation whose parents were in World War II, was the French Resistance broadcasts.
Radio.
And there's absolutely an echo of that in there, isn't there? So that's very strong. And then these strange neighborhoods, particularly near the open air market where Orphée tries to follow death through, which is, as he remarks to Urtubiez later, strangely empty. So I don't know, I guess they filmed it at 4 in the morning or something. But it's that whole neighborhood where he is clearly has the look of a part of a city that's been through something. So even without it ever being overtly addressed, there is this sort of post-war, post-occupation feeling and words fail me. Yeah, by the way, would you guys know what neighborhood is that market in? Where did they film that sequence? Would you know?
I think the first opening, I know the cafe, it was actually
Right.
in a neighborhood known as Les Lilas, which is like not
Yes.
central. And I think it was probably easier for them to film there at the time because it's a
Right,
little more
right.
village-like compared to central Paris.
Sure.
So I'm not sure if that scene as well is also a continuation of Les Lilas.
I don't know, but I was thinking also concerning the look of the post-war era. I was thinking especially about the zone itself because it's so very run down. It was shot in Saint-Cyr to locate it precisely. But yeah, the zone feels like it's been bombed, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I'm sure it must be true. Well, you guys are very much younger than me, but I was born 10 years after World War II, and my city, Liverpool, had been the victim of the German Blitz as well. So that notion of walking through ruin, there were still a lot of ruined buildings, of bombed out buildings when I was a kid. It took Liverpool in the north of England a good 20 years to rebuild after the war. So yes, I mean that has a direct echo, even for somebody who I didn't live through the war, but that look, that and the feelings that are conjured by the feel of bombed out buildings. The zone is again this sort of wonderful, unexpected mix of the beautiful. And it's a place you would presumably never want to go to, but in the movie you kind of never want to leave. It's like, oh, this is the portal, this is the limbo, this is the place between the worlds. And while we're on the look of it, that's the other great thing that obviously Cocteau is, well, is many things, but we can also claim him as a fantasist. And some of his work can visually, I mean, especially La Belle et Bête, obviously, but can visually reflect a fairy tale, ethereal quality. But the thing about Orphée is, and especially as you say, Frank, the bombed out building look of the zone, it doesn't have what one would traditionally think of as a fantasy look, certainly not a fairy tale look. It really has. I realize I'm about to quote myself from that essay I mentioned that I'd done earlier, which is, very rude to quote oneself. But it's shot in that kind of monochromatic neo-realism of much post-war European cinema, And weirdly, perhaps not weirdly, the fact that it looks neorealist, it does not hamper the fantastic elements at all. It really boosts it. It's like if the fantasy element is the diamond, we're not seeing the diamond in a prepared setting, in a beautiful gold ring for the diamond to be mounted on. It's like the diamond is glinting through the ruined rock of the buildings, through which these fabulous creatures move. The thing, maybe, I don't know if you guys can help on this. I think it was probably an arbitrary whim. But it struck me for the first time in this recent reviewing that Death, the princess, her black dress changes into a white dress twice. And I can't really work out why. It's, well, she's about to, I think in both cases, she's about to take one of the newly dead through a mirror, one of them being Eurydice, I guess. But it seemed, and again, this is far from a complaint, but it seemed idiosyncratic. It was just like, no, it's just magic. Those things can happen. It is black, it is white, she is life, she is death.
Well, what I
I don't know if you have
about,
any.
I don't know if that's what he had in mind, but I'm thinking about the negative of the film, about this ability to, and actually he plays with the negative of the film when the car, the Rolls-Royce,
That's
moves
great.
to a place. You can see the landscape being depicted as a negative image. So the thing I'm thinking about, and just one thing that came to me while we were talking about the zone and about the bombed out aspect of it, is the fact that France was split into two zones during World War II, the occupation zone and the Vichy regime. So
Vichy, sure.
perhaps that's one
Direct.
possible way to read the what the zone is all about.
Well, yeah, well, again, passing from one to the other, and of course, passing again through a very traditionally human way of passing. I believe I'm right in that the moment the train goes through the crossing and the car, it's at that point that the view through the windscreen becomes negative, I think.
Oh,
So
yes.
it's like we've literally crossed the border. Yeah, and I'm so glad you mentioned that because. Because again, one of the marvelous things about the movie, which today's overly eager CGI users could certainly learn a lesson from, is that all the magic in the movie, I guess with the exception of the negative, because that's a laboratory trick, but everything else is essentially in camera. It's so traditional. Just run the film backwards so the gloves magically fit on. Obviously, the famous hand through the shimmering mirror.
Turning the camera
Again, the
back.
backward footage to make the dead rise. I mean, that's great. And again, it's we spoke earlier about the efficiency of the movie and its telling. The fantastic hits us in the face, what, like 11 minutes in? Well, after Sejess dies, they put him in the car, so maybe it's 20 minutes in. But then when the princess just in her very cold, efficient way says, Levez-vous, and Sejess rises from the bed, and it's just, sure, as grown people and analysts, we look at it and say, oh, yes, they filmed it backwards. He just fell back onto the bed. But the first time you see it, it's like, oh, that's not normal. We feel we are in the presence of the bizarre in a very visceral and real way. And all those tricks, because I'm guessing he had no money. It's certainly not a high budget film. But it has more sense of wonder and sense of the magical, in its low budget and in its cleverness, in its in the simple tricks that work wonderfully. And I guess again, it's like he's harkening back, to the father of fantastic cinema, another Frenchman, a plurist to your country, Georges Méliès, because it's like all that. I don't think there's any tricks in visual tricks in Orphée that Méliès hadn't done 40 years earlier, So it's beautiful to see that through line in there.
And I think
And
it connects.
I mean, there's all kinds of connections to other examples of great French cinema, fantastic or otherwise, because of course Maria Cazares was also in Les Enfants de Paradis, another favorite movie of mine. If you're not making a list that is only fantastic, I would have to include Les Enfants in that list. And she's in there, and what was and that, and I had assumed a Franju connect. I mean, obviously there is a Franju connection simply because they knew each other and they used some of the same musicians. But I guess there isn't a performer in common. I'm getting it mixed up with Melville. Melville's first movie was a Cocteau adaptation, right? But oh, and no, but did Franju do a Cocteau? Trying to think. I mean, obviously not Blood of the Beasts, obviously not Eyes Without a Face, maybe not, but clearly that same sense of wonder, and specifically Francophile sense of wonder that you get in Orphée. I also got a couple of years later when I first saw Judex, Franju's Judex, in that same little art house in Liverpool. But I guess there isn't a through line of casting the way I thought there was, but all those movies are folded together in my head and my heart. So,
There is a little cameo of Melville, which is interesting, in Orphée. So that,
Oh, who is he? Is he one of the tribunal?
no, he's not in the tribunal. I think earlier he's one of, I mean, there's a very brief appearance, and I noted down somewhere what to call him because I don't even know what this role would be called, and it's a split second. I actually had to read about it before I could recognize him in the film. But it's
Oh, I
just
didn't know. That's great. I'll go and look at it again now.
all of those little Easter eggs that you always find in Cocteau with that wonderful people of his friends and artists around him. I just love that.
But
I was thinking about the very simple quality of the tricks that he's using in camera, and I was thinking that perhaps that could be connected with the fairy tale nature of the work, that there is a certain childish simplicity to the wonder that is generated this way.
Yes, I think that makes perfect sense. I think there's probably budgetary reasons as well,
Of course.
but yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. But yeah, because I mean, I obviously Cocteau is very complicated and intellectually rigorous artist, but he's certainly childlike rather than childish. He certainly had a childlike readiness to marvel at things in all the forms. Even, I mean, again, it was a pleasure to see those opening titles with his hand-drawn title cards. And even in a lot of the graphic work he does, again, you can never look into the head or heart of somebody. You can only judge the work that results, but it's so he might have suffered as he was doing them, but it doesn't feel like that, does it? You look at the things and it's look at the effortless hand as if he just does it because it's like, ah, it should look like this, and there it is. So yeah, pretty great.
And as a young person watching the film the first time, what did you feel about this relationship to art and immortality that's so important in the film? Do you feel
Oh,
that
it
something
was.
evolved or?
Has the feeling about it evolved, did you
Yes,
say? Or
especially I'm not sure when you first saw the film if you had already begun, publishing writing or having writing that went out into the world, and if that's shifted your relationship to the film.
I had not begun writing, but the reason I saw it with Doug is that Doug, I, and Clive. We're all Liverpool natives, and we just started working together. We had a little theatre company, They were a couple of years older than me, so I should say they had a fledgling theatre company that I joined. I mean, it makes it sound like it was a going concern. We were kids, you know, but they, you know, Clive always had very big ideas and very big ambition. So we were very much consciously and probably very self-consciously and very pretentiously and very annoyingly, we were very self-consciously young artists looking to, you know, reach the world, if not conquer it. So yeah, there was definitely an appeal of, oh, we're not crazy. You know, I mean, this is very secondary to the primary meanings of the film, of course. But yeah, without doubt, there was that sense of, oh, wait, he's in the gang too. This is our crowd. These are our people. So that was, you know, wonderfully affirming. Again, you know, how consciously I thought this at the time, I've no idea, but I see now that yeah, that's exactly what a slightly nervous blue collar working class wannabe artist. You see something like Orphée, or indeed Les Enfants de Paradis, because although that's not fantastic, it is about art and committing to a life on the boards, you know. So it's really important, I think, for young people, particularly from non-posh backgrounds, where you know you're expected to either go to the factory floor at worst, or maybe be an elementary school teacher at best, you know. I hasten to add, I'm not insulting either of those professions, both of which are, but you know, if you want to make art, it's very hard to persuade one's blue collar contemporaries. So yeah, it's great when movies or any form can reach across the gap between those who have achieved and those who hope to achieve. Can have this sort of handshake or the secret wink, you know, the high sign, as Buster Keaton would have it, the high sign that lets you know, oh yeah, that's our gang. There are people, there is a tribe somewhere. So I don't know whether that feeling, Marissa, I don't think that's evolved, because I think that's just a pure direct, well, we should be so lucky. I was going to say, you know, a similar feeling cocktails here, but that sense of, at least I can get on the ground floor of whatever ivory tower he might be at the top of, we can, it sounds like there's a way to get in the building at least. So I think that hasn't necessarily evolved, though. I think, you know, possibly now, because you're full of piss and vinegar when you're 20, you just think, yeah, that's great, there's a tribe we can belong to. Now, as an older man, it's very poignant to me to think that it's important that there are things like that out there to send semiotic signals to people who want to do it. And obviously, as you guys have touched on, it's a movie about art and it, art, the artist's relation to their work, and you know, specifically, it's a romance between life and death. It's a romance between mortal and immortal. It's a romance between natural and elemental, and we love it for that. For that, because I think, you know, nearly all. You know, I mean, right down to like, and again, I'm not knocking them, I love them, lowest level B movies. They're all about, weirdly, the romance between the beyond and the mundane. And, you know, in some of the movies, it's, as Lady Gaga would say, it's a bad romance, because there's, you know, there's a girl and there's a monster and he's trying to get her, you know, but it's kind of a romance, just not a good one. And then, well, that's interesting too, isn't it? Because there's a kind of flip here in the sense that there is usually the uncanny sets its cap
Mm.
at a human. And it's usually a girl, it's usually a woman, a female in the movies. In this movie, of course, the uncanny sets its cap at a man. But any man would love a cap to be set at him if the cap was being worn by Maria Cazares. But I think it does. It makes more obvious, possibly because of the slightly unusual gender swap. It does make more obvious what a lot of movies have as subtext, which is this romantic pursuit, a mutual pursuit of life and death. And just to pick up on something we said earlier, I referred to we have this very the narrative conclusion of the movie, which we're very happy with, and feels humanly satisfying, is that Orpheus returns to Eurydice because of, the princess's self-sacrifice. She gives him back to the human love. But the truth is, thematically and even emotionally, I think we as viewers, we know that the real, the important relationship is Orpheus and the princess. And it doesn't undercut the ending of the movie at all, but clearly there is a sense that Eurydice is, she's certainly, the least regarded character in the movie. She has her own personality, and she too has an elemental fall in love with her. Ertugis falls in love with Eurydice as a nice balance to the princess falling in love with Orpheus. But she is almost the incidental victim of the narrative, because what the movie actually seems to say, as opposed to that narrative conclusion of happy, unbearable narcissist Orpheus back with his wife, it's really saying that all human relationships, well, I shouldn't say it's saying this. Cocteau is playing with the idea, perhaps is a kinder way to say it, that all human relationships are as nothing compared to the relationship of the artist to the muse, even when, or especially when, that muse is death. And the fact that Orpheus, I think it hit me on this last reviewing that Orpheus has that line about somebody says to him, "Do you know death?" I think it's Hertebes, says, "Do you know death?" And Orpheus says, "I write about death. I have known death." And then Eurydice, metaphorically slaps his face, says, No, you know death. You met her." And again, it's that first revelation, oh, that's who she is. Oh, shit. But the fact that, in a way, Cocteau was saying Orpheus' theme and muse has always been death. So he was fated. Well, as in the myth, of course, he was fated to meet her, and he didn't know she'd be in a fabulous little black dress, but he knew he was gonna. I realized this time as well, aesthetically, Maria Cazares as the princess from another country, as they say, it was great, but. In that fabulous black dress, it's like she's standing in the middle of an aesthetic arc, and at one end you have, and again, talking about post-war Paris, at one end you have the Coco Chanel little black dress, or even the Dior new look at this end, and at the other end you've got Vampira and Morticia and even Elvira. And Cazares is right there in the middle of that, in which he is nowhere near as. And again, I love Vampira and Elvira, and I especially love Morticia, But she's nowhere near as cartoonish as that. But she's also not as, and again, I love Chanel and Dior, but she's not as mundane or as quotidian as they are. And it's she just seems to hit that perfect sweet spot of, yeah, I don't know, the midpoint between Chanel and Morticia. That's how I will think of her in the future. The midpoint. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I think it might also be linked to the timelessness we were talking about. There is something abstract about her look that makes it very difficult to pinpoint where it belongs, if it belongs in time or in a
Yes.
school. Or, I would like to come back to what you were saying about belonging to the tribe of artists that is being discussed in the film. The trilogy you mentioned of King Kong, Bride of Frankenstein, and this film, in which they are all looking for some sort of forbidden knowledge, aren't
Right.
they? And in the three instances, this forbidden knowledge happens to be death, isn't it? Or to be their death.
Well, it's yes, those are the consequences. Well, I guess Carl Denham doesn't die in Kong, right?
Oh, so, sorry, maybe I can slightly change what I said. I mean, Orpheus is about going into hell and bring back his wife, and that's a bit what King Kong is a bit too. I mean, you go into
Absolutely.
a spatial hell instead of an abstract one and bring back
Right.
sort of creature from the beyond, and so do you in The Bride of Frankenstein. I mean, you bring something back from death, just like you do in Orpheus, don't you?
Yes. Yeah, but it absolutely, you're 100% right, Frank. And the thing about Bride is Henry Frankenstein is the sort of gullible patsy in that movie, because the questing intellect there is Pretorius, the magnificent Ernest Thesiger. And in a way, his impulse is more, sounds so reductionist to say, but is infinitely more playful than Orpheus or even Carl Denham's in Kong, because he wants to mess with things. He has his little homunculi, and the reason he sought out Henry Frankenstein is because size has always been my problem. You achieved that, Henry, together. And so you ha and obviously, I should preface this for people who don't know me, that all my life I've had very close, very best gay friends. So if I loosely talk about Thesiger's campness in his performance, it is said absolutely with affection and delight. But there is no doubt that I'm sure with James Whale's urging, Thesiger camped it up to the max, self-consciously, delighting in messing with nature, which I guess is probably the serious under, because then you could have a, in the same way that somebody back in those days, sadly, like half the people in that movie, Colin Clive, James Whale himself, Thesiger for sure, they would be regarded as against nature by conventional wisdom at the time. So the fact, and thank you for prompting this thought, Frank, because I've never thought of that. The fact that Pretorius is just playing with this shit for the sake of playing with it, is a kind of in-your-face shaken fist at conventional wisdom. It's like, yes, I'm against nature. Look at me be against nature. So yeah, the three movies do feel very linked to me. And it was interesting that you said trilogy, because of course that reminds me that in Cocteau's Head, at least, he had his own trilogy, Blood of a Poet and Testament of Orphé, which sort of bookend Orphé. I mean, for me, Orphé is the masterpiece of the three, but I love all of them. But yes, very, very good point about Kong and Bride.
I'd love to come back to something you said earlier about this idea of the film. You know, I have film students who might think of cinema like this as something for intellectuals that wouldn't necessarily be for a working class student who's interested in more
Right.
Hollywoodian narrative cinema. And I feel sad about that because I think there are very interesting links between Cocteau's work and what we know today as classics of or mid to late 20th century horror and fantastic genre classics, and the
Sure.
influence that so many of those techniques that we've been talking about today and so many of those themes had. I'm thinking a lot about this clash between a contemporary setting and something ancient, perhaps in the form of an archetype that all comes back to this fear of death and this confrontation with death. And I wonder if you might make the link with your own work. Do you feel that this film was somehow in your DNA and then appears in some of the work that you've written?
I won't pretend to be able to analyze any unconscious echoes, but yeah, absolutely, consciously, absolutely. I mean, I literally have Joey, my female protagonist in Hellraiser 3. She literally walks through Cocteau's mirror. I mean, I just that's how she gains access to our version of the underworld. So the going through the mirror was very conscious. I've also in more than one movie, and often in friends movies where they've asked me to do a little under the table help, so you know I'm not necessarily credited on the movie, but I've often put the radio transmissions in. I mean, I think I've got it in Hellraiser 2 or Hellraiser 3, I can't remember. We certainly got the old radio, so I can't imagine that I didn't say, have them say this. But I've also, my friend Tony Randall, who directed Hellraiser 2, he was, I can't remember which of his movies it is. It was a later movie. It mightn't have been a horror movie, but he's for some reason they needed a radio, you know, radio signals to be playing in the background. So I just shamelessly lifted some of the Cocteau or Apollinaire, whoever it was, suggests lines from Orphé. And I mean, oh, and in Hellraiser 4, the reason Angélique, my pre-cenobitic demon, she's called the princess because of the princess. She's again absolutely in my head, that was she's a nastier version of but yeah, I mean, yeah, I mean, through and in my obviously most people would know me for the movies, of course, but in my novels I have again, I mean, I wouldn't dignify myself by calling them influence. It was just like I just pop in quotes here and there and hope that some readers at least will go, oh, I know what that is. So yes, very, very consciously, I doff the cap is how I would put it. And yeah, I'm sure there are also unconscious influences. The whole notion of being fascinated with the interface between life and death, I think. You know, apart from the fact that we're all human, so once we realize our own mortality, we are inevitably interested in, oh my God, I hope there's something. Like, wouldn't it be great if we really could walk through the mirror? Wouldn't it be great if death looked as hot as Maria? So we come to that realization ourselves, but yes, that movie, those movies, I've lost track, but yes, yeah, absolutely. What you're
Hellraiser
saying.
2 also is a descent into hell to bring back someone, isn't it?
Right, absolutely, yeah. So yes, he's all over the place in And I said, oh no, I guess I did. At some point in, I can't remember if it was Hellraiser 2 or Hellraiser 3, but you know, As I say, Doug was the person I saw Orphée with for the first time, and he was a huge admirer of Cocteau as well. And it didn't make the movie. I can't remember now. I literally can't even remember which one it was. But at some because you know Cocteau had that famous. In fact, he echoes it in the dialogue of Orphée. But my God, I'm going blank. What's it? Oh, Diaghilev. Wasn't he challenged by Diaghilev? You know, he wanted Diaghilev to take him, the young Cocteau, as seriously as Diaghilev took Picasso and Sarti and the other people he's working with. And Diaghilev's instruction, wagged finger instruction at the young Cocteau was, "Étonnez-moi, astonish me, John, astonish me." And at some point, I wrote, because I knew it would make Doug smile. In one of the movies, I gave Pinhead the line, you know, a human had said something that played into that asshole's hands, and Pinhead replied, "Astonish me." But it didn't make the cut, you know, it didn't, we never filmed it. But it was in the scripts for one of them. So yeah, I can't help but quote that movie visually and verbally all the time.
I love that connection, and it's so interesting too, this link with Diaghilev, because my original background is in dance history, and ballet libretto that Cocteau wrote and designed called The Young Man and Death, which is, you know,
Yes.
close chronologically to Orpheus. So
Of
it's really,
course.
really great to see the links across and to really understand that he was really playing with similar ideas on stage and in moving images, just applying different techniques. But I think the mask, the death mask that we see in Orpheus of the skull face, is actually the same one that's used in the ballet as well.
Oh, that's great. I didn't know that.
It's also
Oh, good, good.
interesting to know that Radiguet, who was a poet close to Cocteau, once told him that a poet should not astonish people, that he was not supposed to overdo things. So it's interesting to see this balance between the two.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Right, because of course Diaghilev is all about the overstatement. You know, even the coats he himself wore, it's like, you know, he believes in overdoing it, I would think. So that's I'm sure you guys have seen The Red Shoes, the Paul and Pressburger movie, because obviously there's a visual echo of Diaghilev in the character there. Oh, and again, speaking of that sort of signal to young wannabe artists, that opening sequence where the young students pile into the area of the theatre, which in England we call the Gods, as in Les Enfants de Paradis, another crossover. But when they all pile in to the cheap seats, to the Gods, to watch the ballet at the beginning of The Red Shoes, and they cheer him when he appears in the box, and that's again, that sense of tribal connection between, look at them, they love art, and these are their heroes. Yeah, so it's great the way all these movies we like all tie together and cross-reference.
Absolutely. And the way that mythology also merges with reality. I was reading an article the other day, and someone referenced the Red Shoes, and they were mistaken. They confused the fictional universe of the film with dance history, and they actually referred to the Ballet Russe, Diaghilev's company,
Oh, right.
as if that had really been the
It
company
really been the one,
film.
yeah.
And I thought it was hilarious. And this seems to be something that comes up with Cocteau too. I think with all these references to the artists that he works with that appear in the film Orpheus, and then this kind of mixing of the mythological with the then current status of different
Sure.
cultural figures.
And you also find this inside the movie itself with Segeste, whom Orpheus hates when he's alive, but whose poetry he loves when he receives it on the radio.
Yes.
Very interesting, this dichotomy of his relationship to suggest how it varies from total hatred at the beginning. It doesn't
Right.
speak to him at all. And then all of a sudden, when it comes from the beyond, all of a sudden it becomes wonderful,
Right.
quoting it.
Yes, exactly. Well, he doesn't know it's from his rival, does he? And I guess by the time they're in the tribunal, it's I can't remember if Orfe's in the room when they say it, but it is made overtly clear that Segesta wrote the lines. But I think that that's very honest telling in terms of artistic jealousy and rivalry that of course Orpheus hates Segest because he is the younger, newer version of Orpheus. I mean, visually as well, you know, they've both got the same blonde pompadour. And without getting too much into the bedroom biographical, at the time they made the movie, I think I'm correct that Jean Marais was a former lover of Cocteau, and Edouard Demeet Segest was the current boyfriend, I think.
I'm not certain, but it's possible.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure Cocteau slept with all of them.
Yes.
I mean, but at which stage, who was with whom, I'm not sure. But I think I'd heard that somewhere that Demeet was a. So, and again, I'm not suggesting that this was done consciously. It would be kind of mean of Cocteau if this was true, but that would have a biographical echo if the younger Edouard Demeet had replaced Marais in Cocteau's affection. Well, obviously, their lifelong affection was a real thing, but as a paramour, that would be something to then have him play the older displaced poet who resents and hates the younger one. And also, it's also very telling about artists, I think, that you only waste your hatred on people who you know might be good. Like, you don't bother being jealous of somebody whose work you don't like. You know, it's like, well, it doesn't matter that they outsell me. I know their work is trash, but the ones who, like, well, I outsell them, but oh, they're really good. Artistic jealousy is a terrible, terrible thing, and I think that's very accurate in the movie, that it's like the younger, better version of me is an artistic nightmare.
And it's interesting too that it's only once he's dead that he somehow becomes immortal. I like this
Right.
switching the side of things that happens because death in the film is very much, it's not an absolute.
No, clearly not.
Go to death
Back and
and come
forth
back.
all the time.
Yeah. And you get changed. I mean, it's like you're diving into yourself and bringing back things. I mean, which is what, when you're a poet, I mean, you die to the world and bring back images from your depths, don't you?
Absolutely, yes. No, absolutely right. And also, there's that's 100% correct, Frank. But there's also this sort of weird obsession we, the artistic community collectively have with poets should die young. I mean, we don't feel that intellectually, but there is a sort of visceral level on which, well, all the good ones do die young. You know, there's the myth of Chatterton, which turns out was fake. But then, Keats was dead at 25, and didn't Radigay die young as well, the guy you mentioned? Yeah.
And
There's.
yeah, I was going to say in the 20th century, the answer is the 27 Club,
27,
right?
yes.
Oh, yeah, right. That's exactly the equivalent, right? Is Amy Winehouse the most recent member, or have we had another one since?
Might have been.
Because there was that clump of them in the 60s and 70s, and then Kurt Cobain, and then Amy Winehouse. Yeah, it's I think the friends and family of all Well, artists generally, but musicians specifically, they almost breathe a sigh of relief on the 28th birthday. You know, it's like, oh, okay, maybe we've got them till their 40s now, you know.
It's interesting because on the other side of the spectrum, you've got Woody Allen and Clint Eastwood, who are still making wonderful music.
Absolutely, yes. I guess Woody isn't quite 90 and Clint is 92, but they're essentially the same generation, yeah. And of course, that's very. I grew up with both of their filmographies being very important to me, and to my entire generation, of course. And I hope this isn't true, but though I think it officially they have now both said we've directed our last movie. I think Clint said Jura number two was going to be it, and I think Woody's last movie is in French, so Coup de chance, which I thought was pretty good. Not first tier Woody Allen, but the fact that these guys can still crank out, at worst, proficient middle brow filmmaker. Well, Woody would be so insulted at the notion that anything he ever did would be called middle brow. But whereas Clint would just shrug. Not sure what that means, but I might shoot it. But yeah, no, it's great. It's fantastic. And the great thing about those two as well, it's very interesting that you mention them, is they're so old school. Because their generation doesn't have massive filmographies the way the people they both revered did. So they really are both of them generationally linked, obviously, but also linked in that sense of they just kept working. They don't have, it's not like, who'd be, it's not like Raymond Chandler gave us seven novels and that was it. And Harper Lee gave us one, but they are very old school. Workaholic is an insulting term. They're just proficient and efficient. And they, I mean, what have they both done? Like 60 directed features, probably each, something like that. It's phenomenal.
Like Hitchcock, who made 53 movies,
Right,
is
right.
as well. And I mean, it seems to me that those people, their life is art. I mean, that's how they breathe, and they need to produce every year a new work of art because that's what they do.
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And but for instance, Lynch, who I also revere, and what a sad loss. But clearly art was literally his life and breath. But we don't get 50 features from him. I was going to say we don't get 50 features from Spielberg or Scorsese, but I guess they're getting up there now.
Pretty much.
But yeah, right. But Eastwood and Allen, yeah, they seem to be a throwback to that kind of, I show up for work, I shoot the thing, I start on the next thing.
In the case of Lynch, I just want to perhaps precise that even though he hasn't made that many movies, he's been active on other forms of
Oh, all yes.
the time, painting and
Music.
music. He's
Absolutely.
been constantly producing works during
No
all.
doubt. Yes, indeed. And I'm glad he did all those things, and I'm glad he gave us the films he gave us. I just wish there had been more. I was genuinely sh I obviously we were saddened, but I was genuinely shocked when we lost him because he seemed. Well, funnily enough, he looked vigorous, partly because, like Jean Marais and Edouard Demeth, he too had this fabulous grey pompadour. And so, I don't know. And he had that sort of rugged look of, I mean, how old was he when he, 80? 80, was he pushing 80?
Think seven.
Yeah. But he did not look frail. I mean, obviously we'd heard about the emphysema and that was very sad. Though As a former smoker, I can only admire the speech he made after the diagnosis had gone public. And he said, I loved smoking. And he acknowledged that the price he paid for it was the emphysema, but he didn't apologize for the smoking. He loved it. That's,
Experience.
well, I don't want to encourage any young people listening. You shouldn't smoke, it's bad. But I thought it was
Have a
kind of,
vice, embrace it.
yeah, right. It's, well, yeah, that's usually good advice.
And from a utilitarian point of view, I mean, 78 when you've been smoking all your life is not that bad.
I guess that's right. I guess that's right. Yeah. Yeah, he just seems so timeless. And I mean, obviously he didn't seem young in inverted commas, but he did seem, I thought we'd have another 10 years, you know, so I was shocked and saddened.
And I think he also thought, or perhaps hoped, that he would have another 10 years. I mean, he had new projects all the time. I mean,
Right.
you know, some people, they come to the end of their inspiration, but it felt like
Yes.
he still had so much more to say.
Right.
But talking about work and inspiration, what are you currently working on?
What my funnily enough, my whenever people are foolish enough to ask me to go and talk to writing classes or creative writing classes, I always say to them, what you should do is try and have my career in reverse, because I started in the movies, which, I mean, you know, it wasn't big pictures, but it paid pretty well. And then I did a couple of novels, and that pays okay. And then for the last 20 years, I've essentially only been doing short stories. Doesn't pay at all. Yeah. So whenever I talk to writing students, I say, try and do it the other way around. Start with short stories, then do some novels. And then, you know, as you get into your 50s, do some movies. It'll give you some retirement money. So really, actually, seriously, for the past 20 years, I've really only been doing short. And I've been very lucky. Everything I've written has been published. But I'm very slow. So I've had a couple of collections come out in the last 10 years. I will eventually, at a glacial speed, inch my way towards another one. But I did, funnily enough, having said that that was the sequence I worked in, out of the blue, a year and a half ago, an old friend of mine called me and asked me to come and work with him on a TV show that he was doing. And this is because it was the BBC and Amazon, I had to sign a very draconian NDA, which we don't approve of NDAs, but if you want the job, you have to sign them. So I'm not actually allowed to mention what it is right now. And I hate people who do this vague th so
We understand.
I'll happily tell you in private afterwards,
Okay.
but just on the record, I might be sued if
Understood.
so but oddly, in terms of what I've been doing, without naming names, I've been writing several episodes of a TV show over the last 18 months. So that was a nice little sort of throwback to what I used to do. But essentially, I'm a small scale prose fiction man now. So,
And
yeah.
for our listeners who are fans of your work, when do you think they might look for an announcement regarding the television series? When do you think an announcement might be forthcoming?
Well, the thing is in the can now. They're in post-production. So
Maybe in a year.
probably, I don't know. I mean, it might be out by Christmas this year, or it might not.
Should they follow your website then to stay aware of?
Oh, the second I know anything, I will be shouting about it. Yes, sure. Actually, I really, I'm very bad at keeping up my website these days. Like most people, I do all my announcements on social media. So if anybody is kind enough to be interested, they can find me on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. And the two new ones, Threads and Blue Sky, though
Oh, yes. I
they
know.
don't seem to have any traction at all yet, do they? I don't know.
It was a nice
But
idea.
yeah, right.
So we usually end the podcast episodes by asking one question to our guests. The question is, do you think there is something we should have asked that we haven't asked?
Oh, interesting. Specifically about the movie we're discussing, or just in general?
To your life and work, if there's anything else you'd like to touch upon.
No, I think it's I thought your questions and observations were fantastic, and it was a pleasure to speak with both of you. Now, here's the thing. Again, a beautiful French phrase, l'esprit d'escalier. Is it l'escalier? L'esprit de l'escalier, spirit of the staircase. I'm sure that as soon as we go off, I'll think, oh, damn, I wish we'd talked about,
Then you'll just have to come back because I'm
Oh,
sure.
well, that'll be great. That would be lovely. That would be very, very nice. No, this has been wonderful. And thank you guys for inviting me. And thank
Thank
you.
you. Thank you so much. It's been wonderful to speak with you. And we are soon going to stop the recording, and you can tell us
All
off
the juicy stuff. Oh,
the record.
yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to After Images. Please subscribe on your favorite podcast app and follow After Images podcast on social media.
After Images.